Welcome, everybody, to episode 5 of Silver Lining for Learning. My name is Scott McLeod from the University of Colorado Denver. My co-hosts today are Kurt Bonk from Indiana University and Chris Deedy from Harvard. Our special guest today is Will Richardson. Many of you already know Will from his extensive work on this topic, and so we're delighted to have you, Will. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, you guys. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, Will, we're just going to launch right in. You know, you've been talking about the need to rethink learning, teaching, and schooling for a really long time now. So maybe before we start talking about schooling during the global pandemic and some potential silver linings that could come out of all this, let's lay down some context. So I'm going to start by asking you to outline some of the challenges that you saw in schools before all of this happened.
Well, I think all of us have been talking about this for a long, long time. And it's something that I think all of us understand is a difficult conversation for a lot of educators to have, because it really, if you're going to have this conversation, and I think one of the things that's happening right now with the pandemic is that it's forcing us to have this conversation in an existential sense, right? That it's beginning to force us to cut to the very foundation of what we do and what schools are and what happens inside of classrooms and all that kind of stuff. So as you know, Scott, and you know, Chris and Kurt, you know too, that I'm pretty far out there when it comes to the ways that I think schools need to operate and what they should be. And so I think there's a lot of inherent problems in schools just from the get-go. And I want to, you know, with the caveat that I think schools are exceedingly important in our communities, I'm not an advocate for getting rid of schools. I think that having kids in classrooms with caring adults who can really inspire them and push them to greater heights than they can get to on their own is an extremely valuable function of schools, aside from all the other functions in terms of, you know, keeping kids in their care for, you know, an 8-hour day and some of the things that you've been writing about in terms of, you know, for a lot of kids, just providing food and shelter. And so there's lots of extremely important roles for schools and teachers. But having said that, I just can't get away from the fact that so much of what we do in schools just does not make any common sense when you run it through a lens of learning, right? And so all of my conversations around schools start there. They all start with, what do you believe learning is? How do you believe that it happens? And once you've come up with that definition, then can you say that you are living it in your classrooms? And to me, chunking kids, if we were gonna start all over again and just kind of build it from the ground up, there's no way that we would chunk everything out by subjects. There's no way that we would age group kids in the ways that we do and force them to kind of go down this path of curriculum at the same pace. There's probably no way that we would assess the way that we do, especially since we see all the anxiety and stress and everything else that that's putting on kids, because that really changes the nature of the exercise. It becomes more about getting grades than it becomes about learning. We teach a whole bunch of stuff that kids will not remember, that they will never use, and we teach it just in case, because we think that the world of information and knowledge is scarce, and we're now living in a world where basically almost everything that's in the school curriculum is at our fingertips. We just do a lot of things that just belie our beliefs if we articulate them, as I think most people do, right? So, you know, the question that I always ask is, you know, let's talk about what are the conditions that are required for learning to happen. And what I've been saying in the last month or so is that you want to see learning happen, just look at what educators are doing in this moment. It is powerful to see the ways that they are problem solving, that the ways that they are using inquiry to drive what happens in their lives, the ways in which they are collaborating, the ways in which they're doing it because they have this purpose for serving kids. They're not doing it for a grade, you know, they're doing it for the goal of trying to maintain relationships, maintain connection, all that kind of stuff. This is, I think, the most powerful learning moment for educators, maybe ever. We have been forced into this moment and we have to learn our way through it. And what I've been saying to people is, think about what exists right now around that context, right? People are passionate about it. They are not time constrained so much about it, but they have a real purpose for a real audience. They are collaborating with one another. They are asking questions that they bring to the table. They have agency around those things. Could go on and on about all of the conditions that are existing in this moment for educators around the world. But then when you ask them, as I have been over and over and over again, take a look at the learning you're doing. Now, how does that map to what kids are doing in your classrooms? And it doesn't. When kids are in classrooms, they are waiting to be told what to learn, when to learn it, how to learn it, and how they're going to be assessed on it. There's this huge gap in this moment that I think is really powerful. And it's not easy to bridge that gap. I'm not suggesting that, but I think it is absolutely pointing out right now the real challenges that learning has in schools. I mean, I've been saying this for a long time, but schools were not built for learning. They were built for an education. They were built for teaching. They were built to get kids through a system to achieve a goal that basically originally, at least, was to become a good citizen in a democracy and, you know, have character and all that other type of stuff. But increasingly, later on, has been now more about achieving some type of status or getting some type of diploma or certificate and moving up through the path. And so it's just a really interesting moment. And I know that most people are in survival mode still. I've been doing a lot of work with international school heads, leading groups of like 115 people. A lot of it is just kind of a therapy session, but the rest of it is, a lot of it is also, you know, what do we do? How do we get through this? And, you know, it's powerful and it's fascinating. But I hope what happens when the dust settles a little bit is that people will step back and they will say, okay, what is the difference between what we've just experienced and what we're putting our kids through in school, and then ask some really tough existential questions about what we do in classrooms, how we do it. I think the narrative has to change. I don't think that the narrative in its current form has served kids for a long time, to be honest with you, in terms of an education, quote unquote. But I also think that the narrative has got to change because of technology, because of the ways we can connect, because of our access to information and knowledge and experts, and because of all the agency and self-direction that most of us, but not all of us, but most of us have in our devices and fingertips. And so I think the challenges coming into this moment were huge to begin with, if you really were willing to step back and look at them. Moving out of this moment, I absolutely think that they are existential. And I think that if people aren't talking about them in really deep ways, asking really big questions, then we're going to miss a very, very important moment and an opportunity to maybe do things a little bit more differently that's more aligned with the way that learning naturally happens.
If I can try a metaphor, because it is puzzling how resistant schools have been to change when every other sector of society has become more modern. It's a little like the QWERTY keyboard on the typewriter or the computer. The QWERTY keyboard was designed to make you type slowly so that the typewriter, when in its infancy, wouldn't jam. And we know that there are many better keyboards that can be used to type much more swiftly. And with modern electronic keyboards, you can reprogram the keyboard, so you don't have to buy a new keyboard. But nobody, including me, switches, because unlearning QWERTY and trying to learn some different opposite pattern of letters is so difficult. And it starts in, as a student, it starts in elementary school or kindergarten. So you're programmed in, you're imprinted very early, like the duck that's born and sees a dog and thinks it's a dog. Now, what's happened with the virus, which is a terrible human tragedy, is that all the keyboards have disappeared. And we're having to use voice input. And people are wrestling with how you how you handle voice input as opposed to having the luxury of typing. And they're doing some things better and other things worse. And the question is, can we get people not to just go back to keyboards only, but see the advantage of a combination of voice and keyboards? And second, can we maybe forget enough about QWERTY keyboards that we can switch to some better model?
Well, I think there's the main problem with that is that the narrative of school, the QWERTY keyboard of school, is one that we all know, right? And it's deeply ingrained in our society. It's ingrained in almost every one of our personal experiences. And, you know, when it comes to kids, as parents, and I own two children, right? So I've been through this, but as parents, we're loath to put our kids at risk, or change or something different for our children makes us uncomfortable. And I think parents have a big role to play in this. There's no question about that. But I also wonder the extent to which the technologies that we're using here will actually end up being used longer term in schools. I think some of them will, but my sense of it is that there's going to be a really powerful pull to go back to the way that things were. That's not just because of our narrative, but that's because there are a lot of testing companies and technology companies and tutoring companies that have a whole bunch of money invested in that old narrative and will not support wholesale change that gives kids and teachers more agency and more choice and all that kind of stuff, right? Because basically what we're talking about is, you know, really kind of blowing up or rethinking the curriculum piece of what happens in schools. But I think, Chris, that for that to happen, we're going to have to find some very interesting and appealing and effective models that we can begin to share at scale so that people see that there might be a different narrative and they might, you know, they might move toward that narrative. And I'll give you, you know, I don't see that a lot. I mean, certainly Education Reimagined, which is a group that I really love, has been doing a great job in terms of trying to find learner-centered, that's kind of their phrasing, right? Learner-centered environments and promote those and show what they are. And I think that there are lots of them, but unfortunately, you don't see those so much in big public school systems. They're mostly kind of on the small schools, kind of a little bit on the fringe, and there's powerful learning stories to be told there, but they don't easily kind of move into, you know, the bigger systems. I think mastery.org has done some really interesting work to try to change the whole assessment narrative. And by the way, I think that's a huge one. I really think if those folks in that organization can get us to think just totally differently about the way that we assess, about grades and numbers and all that kind of stuff, that's a pretty big domino that might actually push and force a whole bunch of other things to change moving forward. But we're still pretty far away from that. So I think everybody, not everybody, but I think a lot of people look at schools and education, they say, yeah, you know what, we really could be doing them better. And the statistics show it, by the way. I mean, like I said, we have kids who are really stressed and anxious, highest levels ever of that. We've had kids who are basically disengaged, and we've known that forever. You know, 2/3 of kids showing up in Gallup surveys and whatever else that really aren't engaged in school. We know from research that kids don't remember a lot of this stuff. So, you know, that's all there. But to try to suddenly say that an education for the modern world requires that kids have a lot more agency and self-determination, and that they co-create curriculum with teachers, they come up with their own assessments, they do real work for the world. Again, all the stuff that all these educators are doing right now to try to problem solve and learn their way through this moment, to suggest that then becomes the narrative, it's really, really hard for a lot of people. It's hard for parents because it's different, but it's also hard for teachers because obviously you're changing their own kind of self-understanding of what their value is in the classroom. If it's not content expertise, then what is it? You know, and so I don't know. It's hugely complex, I wish I was more optimistic about that change, that type of change happening at scale. But I just, even with this, even what's been happening, I just don't see it anytime really soon. Maybe down the road, hopefully, but not right away.
So, Will, I'm struck by the culture issue that you've highlighted here, right? So as a school leadership guy, I think spent a lot of time thinking about systems and systems change, right? And Kurt Lewin has this, you know, classic historical model of institutional change where you have to figure out how do you unfreeze things that you do as an organization, change them up, and then refreeze them into a new culture, right? And I think right now what you're saying is that a lot of school systems are in survival mode, but aren't necessarily thinking about that unfreezing, changing, and refreezing cycle.
Yeah, not at all. They can't. There's just no bandwidth for that right now. You know, I mean, again, just through the lens of these calls that I've been doing and some of the coaching calls that I've been doing with leaders, it really is like, how do I get through tomorrow? You know, like if now, what do I do about graduation? You know, how do I close school? How do I open school in September? What are the kind of parameters that I have to use to make sense of that? How do I communicate all this stuff to parents? You know what I mean? I mean, the list is endless and there seems to be almost new questions every day. The biggest one for me is how do you social distance in schools? I mean, how do you do that? I'm not sure that's even possible, to be honest with you. And so people are talking about, well, we have staggered schedules. We have some kids come in on this day, then the other kids, you know what I'm saying, right? So right now there's no bandwidth that most people have or very little bandwidth that they have to talk about, you know, technical versus adaptive change, as Heifetz talks about it, right? So that it's the bigger system stuff and really rethinking or reimagining the way that kids experience school rather than, you know, how can we do this more efficiently? How can we do this more effectively? Depending on how you define effectiveness, by the way, right? So all of that kind of language plays into it as well. I'm not sure, again, that there's gonna be a time for that kind of thinking in the near future with this crisis. My sense of it is, and you know, I know you guys have been doing a ton of reading around this as well, and you can tell me if you disagree. But my sense of this is that, well, first of all, there's not going to be a new normal. It's we're not going to just kind of find ourselves back into this predictable rhythm of what, you know, kind of the world and what schools look like. So that's number one. We have to really, I think, prepare to build cultures that are just adapting all the time and that are really just flexible and resilient and all that kind of stuff, right? But I just don't see... I don't know when we can kind of stop being in survival mode here and start being more in reimagination mode or, you know, let's ask the big questions mode. I think that'll come at some point, but I mean, you know, my son goes to college at Colgate. I mean, Boston University is talking about not having face-to-face classes until January now. And so, you know, it's kind of all over the map. So as much as people want to take advantage of this opportunity, as much as hopefully there are some silver linings to this, right? I'm not sure we're there yet. But again, what my hope is that when they do get a little bit of quiet time or downtime, that all you need to do right now is just reflect. Just reflect. Just look at what's going on. Look at how you, as a, you know, if you're a leader or a teacher or a parent even, look at how you're kind of learning your way through this and just kind of remember that for when the time comes and you want to go, okay, so given what's happened, given the kinds of questions we now have about the future, given the challenges that this particular event has provided us in terms of our systems and structures, how do we now best engage in a conversation that asks the big question, what should education be moving forward? Because I think you guys would agree, I think it can't be what it was, but I don't know the extent to which people are willing to change that old narrative, again, in the short term, and maybe not even the long term, I don't know.
Yeah,
so there's a question that's come in. Scott, did you have something to follow up first?
Yeah, I'm gonna segue us into that. So, Will, I don't know if every school or district is ready to have those conversations in the near future either, but I do know that some are, right? And I think the whole premise of the Silver Lining for Learning initiative is that for people who are ready to start thinking about, you know, what could be next, right? That here's a bunch of ideas to chew on. And what I'm noticing through my Coronavirus Chronicles interviews that I'm hosting on my blog, where I'm talking to school leaders all over the world, is that many of them are starting to think about it because, and I think here's the difference between what you said and what I'm about to say, is that we have to acknowledge that people are coming into the fall or whenever their next school year is with new skill sets. And wrapped around those, some new mindsets about what is possible in terms of rapid organizational change because they've been forced into it. So maybe they're not ready to, you know, metaphorically blow up how we do school like you and I are, and many of us are on this panel, but they are coming back with some existing capacities and skills that they didn't have a few months ago. And it's probably going to be very few school systems that just ignore those and go completely back to what was. And so I'm going to actually ask Kurt and Chris before I ask you, you know, what might be some potential outcomes in the fall of those new skill sets and mindsets? And I think that's what we're hearing from your audience today in this conversation too, is what are some of those new concrete things that might be a little different or more substantively different in the fall because of this experience?
Chris?
Well, I agree that assessment is a big lever. And this is coming out in some of the questions in the YouTube channel as well. And I think what we're seeing is that because there's no way to do conventional summative assessment, people are doing what they should have been doing all along, which is diagnostic assessment that's formative for changes by students and teachers to learn better, and then looking at trajectories of learning over time. That's not a substitute for a summative assessment, but it's actually a much better way to orient a system around learning than it is to orient it around teaching and testing. And I hope that that's one thing that will come back, is that the teachers, even if the system doesn't acknowledge it, teachers are gonna have more trust in their own instincts in terms of how to handle the kind of assessment that lets students improve rather than the kind of assessment that's simply compliance.
I think they're also going to be much more likely to embrace cross-cultural projects, global collaboration across schools, and letting kids take charge of the assignments and to meet the curriculum standards. Their voice might be heard more because they become more self-directed in the learning and take advantage of those self-directed learning kinds of skills. At least that would be my hope. I know in writing The World is Open book, I had a story in there of a young girl who was going to Indiana High School, and her name is Bridie Fennell, and she had to go to Indiana High School because her parents had bought a boat in Brazil, were sailing it back to the U.S. for the next year, and so she had to learn on the boat and have ship dock captains proctor her exams and retired teachers in Grenada. And when they got into port into Charleston a year later, they decided not to move back to Chicago where they were from and stay in Charleston. And they had a problem with some of the schools and some of the teachers there, but their daughter did extremely well because she learned self-directed learning skills on that boat. And I wonder to what degree that the same thing is going to happen here, that kids are finding new ways to learn, adopting new ways to learn, become more confident in their ability to learn on their own or with others that they meet along the way. So I'm curious if Will seen any instances of this happening in the last month and a half. Has there been any aha moments, anything? You've talked a lot about the problematic side, the challenges, but have there been a hot moment saying this could happen again, could be replicated, could find steam in some way, whether it's that my notion of project-based learning, problem-based learning becoming cross-cultural in nature or just school-wide in nature. Will?
Yeah, Kurt. I mean, and most of what I've seen along those lines have not been related to school. Most of what I've seen along those lines are kids who are just doing like the kids, for instance, who got together and have recreated their college campuses in Minecraft so that, you know, they can kind of, you know, have graduation ceremonies virtually because they can't have them in their face-to-face world. Or like my son, who here's a shout out for Nerdball, the new podcast about basketball. You know, they just dropped their third episode. That's what he's been learning and project-based, and he's been collaborating with other people on that. But in his Zoom sessions and online classroom, Not so much, right? And I'm not seeing a lot of that happening. And so I want to go back really fast to what you said, Scott, about people coming back to school with some, you know, some more capacity to use some of these technologies and maybe to do different things. I don't disagree with that, but I wonder what the capacity is. And what I've seen, and this is a distinction I've been making a lot too, a lot of people are saying, well, now we're doing online learning. I don't think we are. I think we're doing online schooling. And I think what's happening is that basically a lot of teachers are building the capacity to do school with technology that maybe they didn't have before. But I wonder the extent to which they're really, again, thinking about and being able to create the conditions for learning to happen, whether it's online or off, right? I mean, I look at my son here, you know, on a regular basis. And again, he's got an interest. It's real life. It's for a purpose. He cares about, he wants to learn more, all those types of things. I would say, and this is another kind of a distinction that I've been trying to make lately. I think if we want a new normal in schools, right? If we want people to come back and use those capacities in ways that create a different narrative or create a different story, then I think I would argue that we got to go back to the old normal for learning, right? And again, learning hasn't changed in a millennium. I mean, the way that we learn as human beings hasn't changed. We're the same as we were when we were on the plains, you know, hunting wildebeest or whatever. The learning that we did had a purpose at the moment. We were, you know, we were collaborating, all that kind of stuff. I don't need to recite that whole list again. But unless we start there, I'll say that again, unless we start there, I'm not sure that all that new capacity and new understanding of teaching practice and pedagogy is really going to infiltrate and change fundamentally the way that learning occurs in classrooms. Because all of us would agree, we want classrooms where kids have agency, where teachers and kids are co-collaborating and creating curriculum as they go that's based on what a kid wants to learn in a moment that he or she needs to learn it, and that it has real relevance in their lives, as opposed to, again, just kind of interesting new ways to deliver curriculum, which is kind of what I'm seeing more of than anything else. And I just want to say again, I'm not throwing teachers under the bus here. I'm not at all, because this is what the system expects. Delivery technology has been used most powerfully by educators to deliver curriculum. And so basically now we're saying, okay, well now the technology, look, we can do all these things. We can connect, we can create together, we can co-publish, we can all that kind of stuff. Yeah, we can, that's great. And now maybe people's eyes are opening up to that. But then to translate that into, again, a narrative or a culture of school that is still primarily about delivery and getting a grade at the end of class so that you can move on to the next class, so you can get the diploma, so you can, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's an opportunity there, but I'm not seeing a lot of that happen just because we're online all of a sudden.
Well, but I think you're being more pessimistic than I am anyway. And I'll make an argument that my late colleague, Clay Christensen, would make, which is that what we need to do is look at disruption. I think you're right. We're not going to go back to anything that looked like education before the virus for a long time, not until there's, if there ever is, a lot of immunity within the society. And that opens the door to alternative models for people who see that the old model is unattainable or broken, and they're looking around and they're looking for something else. And of course, students who are marginalized within the current system, who weren't getting a good education with even with face-to-face learning in this system, are ripe for some kind of disruptive innovation. So again, I think part of our purpose here is not to try to forecast the future, it's to invent the future. And I think that in the seeds of what people are doing are potential disruptive models if we can just put the pieces together.
Yeah, let me just say really fast, and I don't want to sound overly pessimistic. I'm certainly listing in that direction, right? Because I think that it's been so hard. I've been beating my head against this wall for 15 years, and you guys longer. And the changes in terms of the progressive changes that we all are advocating for have not really happened at scale, right? So I do think that there are opportunities, definitely, that, again, people are going to see this differently and they're going to look at it differently. And that's a really, really good thing. But again, I just think that unless it's a conversation about how learning happens in classrooms more than a conversation about how teaching happens in classrooms, we're not going to move appreciably to a different model or a different experience that kids have in school. And, you know, to me, that's the biggest stumbling block or the biggest barrier right now, is that we're not getting to that core conversation, because it's really uncomfortable, because we look at that and we go, oh yeah, you know what, our kids aren't really doing that. And it also, just one last thing, it also depends on how you define what an education is. If we don't change the definition, if we don't rewrite the definition or revise the definition in people's heads as to what an education is, then it is still going to be about what grade point average did you get? How many AP classes did you take? What were your SAT and ACT scores? What college are you going to? All that kind of stuff. And I think all of us would agree that's not really an education any longer. And an education is really now about how well can you learn in the world? How agile are you? How much of a problem solver are you? How can you work with other people to create real solutions to real problems, to create works of beauty and art that have a meaningful purpose? The educated person in the modern world is not someone who's carrying around a whole bunch of information in his or her head that someone kind of stuffed in there because the curriculum told them to do that. It's instead someone who can do what educators are doing right now, learning on the fly and really using that knowledge and using that information to solve problems and hopefully make the whole experience better for their teachers, their kids, whatever else.
So we have a question, another one that's come through from the YouTube channel. As someone who's been promoting blended for, probably close to 30 years now and have a handbook of blended learning that came out 15 years ago. The question here is it feasible to consider juggling schedules of blended learning as a way to move forward while adapting new and better practices? What do you think about blended learning has so many different formats?
I know.
And no one can agree on a definition. An administrator's definition of blended learning is different from what a teacher's definition is, which would be different from what a learner's definition would be. So there's a lot of stumbling blocks because there's a lot of mixed messages about what exactly it is, and then let alone how to implement it. But given that, do you have any take on this question?
So another one of my little riffs is, we love to put adjectives in front of the noun, right? So we love to put blended learning or flipped learning or this learning or that learning. And at the end of the day, you can come up with that whole long list of the different adjectives that we use. But again, I think we're talking more about blended teaching than we are blended learning. And there's a big distinction there, right? If the goal of blended learning, quote unquote, whatever you want to call it, is for at the end of the process, the kids to have mastered a chunk of curriculum, but maybe there's a little bit more choice, or maybe we're doing that through technology and face-to-face or whatever else, that's really blended teaching to me, right? If the outcomes are set by the curriculum or the teacher or the school, then we're using technology to teach our way to that outcome. This is blended learning, right? When you have 115 people on a Zoom call from all around the world who are trying to, discuss what the next steps are, how to keep school open or whatever, that's blended learning, because not only are they doing that in their face-to-face communities with their teachers, their parents, their communities, all that kind of stuff, but they're also then using the technology to connect with other people who may have different experiences, can inform what they're thinking, all that kind of stuff. And that's when it gets really powerful. But again, hopefully no one from Colgate's watching this, right? But what's happening on the technology on the laptop when Tucker's in class is blended teaching more than anything. And so I think that's another distinction that we have to make in that. What do you mean when you say learning? What do you mean by that? And if you can't define it, if you can't articulate it, and you can't kind of run practice through that lens, then I think there's a conversation that needs to be had there.
Anyone from Colgate, put it in the chat window on YouTube. Let us know.
He's going to fail all his classes now, right? So,
okay, Will. So let's move towards hope here a little bit.
Okay.
Because it feels like we do also have some assets, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one of the assets is that as slow as it has been over the last couple of decades, we definitely have many more P12 educators talking about student-driven learning, deeper thinking, you know, more authentic work, using technology to help with those, right, than we had before, right? Like, I just look at sort of the span of schools and districts across the globe, and there's a lot more people that are at least trying to head in those directions than we had 5, 10, 15 years ago. So that feels like an asset to me, right? I mean, heck, Gary Steger even wrote a positive blog post about
that. Yeah, can you believe that? I was shocked.
So
at that moment, yeah.
Even Gary's feeling hope on that. I mean, that's definitely an asset to work with, right? Mm-hmm. We have students and parents at home who, by necessity, over the last few months, have been forced to take charge of student learning and have students direct their own learning in a whole different way than they typically were allowed to in school settings. Right, because the teacher is not there at home to direct the learning for them. Now, not every system, some systems are trying to do a very sort of traditional model and push it out to kids, but we have a lot of other folks who are offloading that learning direction to the student and maybe also the parent, right? Compared to what we had before and trying to rethink some assignments to allow that to happen, because again, the teacher can't control it as tightly because they can't control the environment as tightly. Third asset feels like some of the reflexive resistance to utilizing technology for learning and teaching may be starting to break down because, again, teachers were thrust or forced into technology-facilitated learning modalities in ways that they previously were able to resist, right? And now they have at least some new teaching capacities to draw from in the fall, and hopefully we can help them recognize how students can draw from what they've been gaining and learning as well. So, and then we have parents who have been thrust into the role of learning coaches, as one of our audience members noted, right? And have gotten maybe a more detailed or more robust glimpse at the kinds of assignments that are being asked of their students, both and have both a comparison point for before and after. So all those feel to me like assets that we can build with in the fall. So, and you probably could list some more, right? We all could. So what are some hopeful pathways in the future? How do we take some of those assets? What could we do with those? What might we make happen over the summer and next fall or over the course of the next year or two, recognizing that we have those things to build with?
Well, let me just mention one more real fast, since I've been a, you know, Debbie Downer this whole session, right? So I do think that what I'm seeing is that schools are in making these decisions, these day-to-day decisions about what to do and what to do next, what's kind of surfacing are their core values and commitments and really, you know, their care for children. And I think that that's been a really important piece of this whole event, is that they're making decisions and they're saying, you know, and entities too. I mean, the fact that, okay, we're not going to do grades anymore, you know, because right now that's going to stress our kids out. That's not equitable, whatever else, right? They're using, they're making that decision based on what they feel is best for children. And I've seen a lot more of that. That's not to say that we don't do that on a regular basis in schools, but sometimes I think we lose that kind of, you know, it becomes secondary. It kind of fades because of all the other stuff that we have to do on a daily basis. So I'm really encouraged by that, because if we do get to our core commitments and values and beliefs, I think we're in a really great place if we can begin to live those things. So, you know, moving forward, I do think that parents are huge here. I think this is a huge opportunity for parents, because I think that they are finally getting a up close look at what school is, even if it's in a virtual sense. And they're also getting, I think, some real feedback from their children as to what that experience is and how that's playing out for them. There's obviously a ton of frustration right now, right? Because parents can't go to work and they can't support, you know what I mean? I mean, there's just layer upon layer of challenges with having kids at home. So putting those aside, though, when they're engaged with their children in learning contexts, I think their eyes are opening up a lot. And I think that that's giving us an opportunity to engage parents in a different conversation and to go to parents and say, you know, we really want to invite you into some really, really high level different discussions about what school might be next, because you know, we're learning that what's happening in this space, but also you know, basically what's happening in face to face too is really not as engaging as it could be. And maybe there isn't quite as much happening there as we want it to be. The other thing is too, I think that parents, you know, I don't necessarily like the phrase pain points, right? But as a parent, I'm feeling more fearful about what the future holds. And I'm feeling much more concerned about my kids, even though they're 22 and 20 and they seem like they're going to be okay. I mean, they're pretty resilient kids and they're pretty creative, thankfully, and all that. But I know that there are a lot of parents that I've been talking to virtually that are fearful, and they are looking at the world and they're saying, you know, my kids really do need to be much more resilient. They need to be much more creative. They need to be able to communicate. All of these kinds of skills and literacies and dispositions, which we've been talking about for a long time, I think parents are beginning to recognize that's what's important. It's not, again, so much the content knowledge that's coming out of the curriculum. It's not so much the grades, if we can get away from that conversation about going to college and, you know, that whole path. But I see this as a huge opportunity to engage parents in a different way. And I'm actually working on a little bit of a project around that, to build the capacity of parents to really talk about a reimagination in ways they get beyond their own experience, right? Because it's hard, you know, it's hard for a parent to sit down and really think differently about school if they don't have any sense or any narrative or any story that is different from the one that they experience. So I think that's an opportunity as well. And I'm sure there are others, you know, anytime you have a profound learning moment like this, there's a lot of good things that can happen from that. No question about it. And believe it or not, I am an optimist when I'm looking forward down the road, because I do think that we are going to learn our way through these challenges, and we're going to learn how we learn our way through these challenges from this moment. We have bigger challenges on the horizon, as you know. And right. So, you know, that's going to have to be a disposition that we carry as people when we move forward into that.
So, Will, let me ask a follow-up question. You know, I was struck by a conversation I had with a school leader earlier this week who said, you know, we've already switched over to sort of competency-based student progressions, right? And so for us, coming back in the fall is no big deal. We just start wherever the kid is, right? And just keep on rolling, right? And because they've yeah. walked away from some of those, you know, typical grading or grade level sort of practices, right? And they're really just trying to assess kids in terms of mastery and learning. And yes, it's probably still school determined more than it is learner determined, but nonetheless, they're gonna have a different ability to adapt than another more traditional school, right? And so, you know, what we're gonna find here over the next few years is that the schools and school leaders who have already been trying to work in this direction are going to be in a better place to just keep adapting, right? And so, you know, it would be great to hear a couple thoughts from you about how do we help those people keep moving forward, but maybe more importantly, and this is always the $1 million challenge, right, in terms of systems change, is how do we get other school systems and school leaders to recognize that there are opportunities out there and that you have people next to you who are blazing the path, right, if you're only willing to learn with them. And that has sort of been the challenge for the last two decades, right, is that we have all lived in the space of possibility and opportunity, and everybody here has spent a lot of time putting amazing examples of learning in front of educators and leaders and examples of, you know, front runners and trailblazers. And so how can we do that work in a way that really helps spread the speed of change, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing to do is to help school leaders and you know, just teachers, everyone in school communities, to get really good at telling their stories. I think that people are getting better at that, but I think that they have to, again, So we can choose the stories we tell, right? We can choose to tell stories of traditional success, or we can choose to tell stories of maybe, I don't know if that's the right phrase, but modern success, right? Different forms of success that may be more relevant for kids moving forward. And that would be great. I mean, imagine if that's the way we change the narrative. Imagine if you went to your local realtor and you said, hey, you know what? Why don't you tell this story instead of the one about the good test scores and stuff and college acceptances? Here's some great examples of our kids doing amazing learning in the world, which every school has kids doing amazing learning in the world and in classrooms. Every single school has that. But we haven't done a great job, I don't think, although I would agree with you, Scott, recently we're doing a better job of that. But yeah, it's marketing almost, right? And so how do we build the capacity of people to do that on a regular basis? Because as we all know, one big story isn't going to change the narrative. It's going to be a lot of small little drips of choices that we make about the stories that we tell. And then how we do that. How do we use technology to do that? How do we do that in the face-to-face environment? Assuming we can all get back face-to-face at some point soon. So, to me, I'm a big fan of Yuval Harari, who talks about this idea that we're in between stories right now. And we can write that story, and we should write that story. And we have enough stuff, enough content to write that story and really give parents and give community and give policymakers and others a much different look or a much different sense of what learning in the modern world needs to be, because it's already happening in most places in some form. So yeah, I think that would be the one thing that I would really focus in on. How do you, what story do you choose to tell, and how do you tell it really effectively?
Cool. Thanks,
Will. I recommend that people take a look at his website at Modern Learners and take a look at his Wikipedia page, because you see creativity just flowing right off of there. You know, he's been...
Not my Wikipedia page, Kurt. I wrote that whole thing, so, you know, you don't...
I'm sure you did. Co-founded Powerful Learning Practice, co-founded Change Schools, co-founded Modern Learners, and just co-founded Connective Learning. You have the bug, the innovation bug in you. Every year or so you co-found something. I'm curious though, as I look at this, and it says that you have a book called Freedom to Learn, which Carl Rogers had a similar book.
Right.
So two-part question, to what degree is your book Freedom to Learn based on his? Is it for the 21st century, or and also the principles that you list at Modern Learners, were they first derived when you were writing the book, Freedom to Learn, and then you came out when Modern Learners followed that? And can you tell the audience what Modern Learners is?
Well, so Modern Learners is a site that we created about, Bruce Dixon from Australia and I created about 6-7 years ago now. And Missy Emler is kind of running that site at this point. But what we tried to do there was build a community of people to engage in these types of conversations over the long term. And when we were looking at it, we decided to put together what we saw as the 10 principles for schools of modern learning. And they basically are things like, you know, schools of modern learning have clearly articulated beliefs around what learning is and how that looks in classrooms. Storytelling was one of the 10 principles. Yeah. We actually have an audit at modernlearners.com/audit where people can kind of rate themselves according to those 10 principles. The book Freedom to Learn, it didn't come from Carl Rogers' work, although I really like Carl Rogers' work when he talks about learning and education. But it as you suggested, Kurt, it really was trying to look at how does this kind of modern context really profoundly give us much more freedom to learn in our own contexts, on our own, you know, as individual learners pursuing things that are meaningful and interesting to us. Again, assuming that we have access, which most of us do, but not every kid does, right? So that freedom is not available to every child right now, which is, I think, almost a moral issue at this point. But freedom and agency have just exploded over the last couple of decades. And so that was an attempt to basically try to take that, the way that looks in the modern world, in the real world, and to say, this is what schools could be. And I tell, you know, some pretty interesting stories of kids and schools in that book as well, that, you know, as Scott mentioned, are doing just crazy good stuff when it comes to letting kids run and letting them problem solve. And yet they go, you know, they may not have that kind of traditional experience, but they get into colleges and they end up being very productive members of society and all that kind of stuff. So it is this idea that, you know, there is another path, and that the path moving forward is more about learner-centered, like Education Reimagined talks about it, you know, student-centered, student-directed, self-determined, whatever adjectives or, you know, the ways you want to describe that. But we need to be learners in the world right now. We need to be self-motivated, really, really good learners, because we're not going to be able to keep in our heads everything we need to know. And because, again, we know that most of what we actually do in our lives, we learn on the job or we learn through experience. So learning in the modern world is more complex because there are so many more different opportunities and different resources, different people, all of that. And we have to make sure that our kids really know how to do that well.
Thank you. Chris?
So, Chris, you got some thoughts before I keep going?
I think that one of the things that we're doing with this initiative is something that you've done as well historically, which is just to collect bottom-up models, or parts of models. As you point out, the elephant is a big beast and it has a lot of parts. And if you're going to replace the elephant, it's also going to have a lot of parts. And nobody right now, myself included, has a fully scalable model that's on target. But I do think that we have all the pieces of the puzzle at this point if we just collect them and start to think about ways to put them together. And yes, then once we've got a model that we think is scalable, we have to persuade people to use it. But I sense a hunger now in people who recognize that what they had before was marginal, what they're going to get next is even more marginal. And isn't there something else? This is a window, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Chris. And, you know, I can't help but keep thinking of like big picture schools when we're talking about a different model that is, I'm not sure that's scalable to everyone, but certainly the kind of ethos, the culture, the approach to that in pieces, I think, is a model that people can really take from and implement in smaller ways. I know that there are lots of variants even on that model where, you know, you have just a kind of a regular traditional public high school, but there are groups of kids who are engaged in more apprenticeship type of learning, going out in the community, going to class maybe 2 or 3 days a week, but the rest of the time working with experts, becoming masters. So I agree with you. I do think all the pieces we know what schools should be and what that experience for kids needs to be. Intellectually, we can talk about it and we can articulate it. But it is, the question is, how do you take that idea? How do you find the places that are really working in those kinds of ways? And then how do you bring that to scale? And I'll say again, I just think it comes back to, and without kind of repeating their name too much, but Ed Reimagined is doing another great job of just highlighting these types of stories and telling them through the voices of kids. And that's a powerful voice that I think many times we forget about as well in terms of our own storytelling. So yeah, I totally agree. I think the answers are there, but it's just a question of, you know, how do we kind of, and I'm not sure it's a recipe, but how do we just get all of those pieces on the same table and then work collaboratively to kind of put it together into a different picture? And there may be many different pictures in that, right? But they're all kind of variants on a theme at that point.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go with what Chris said, was that, you know, we're probably not going to replace one size fits all model with another one size fits all model.
Right, absolutely.
So, and if we do, shame on us, right? But given that we have all these sort of interesting pieces to play with, and we recognize much better than we did the last time we reinvented school, what powerful learning really looks like, right? Then we're going to absolutely create I mean, hopefully, right, multiple pathways and multiple models, and then kids and families will have some opportunity to slot themselves into mechanisms that seem to make the most sense for them, right? And so, you know, how do we then as leaders and systems set up opportunities to differentiate, to individualize, to personalize for kids to head in directions that maybe we didn't anticipate, right? Like all of those are going to be parts of the new models, right? And well, you know, I think the other thing for me is that we already have hundreds of thousands of schools that have been playing in different ways with all these pieces, right? Which we can learn from.
Yeah, I mean, Iowa Big is a great example of that, right? Design 39 Campus is a great example of that. You have schools within public systems that are just stepping out and creating space for a very different experience that kids are having. And at least there's a choice for parents and kids to say, yeah, you know what? I want that. I've always felt like if you brought every student and every parent into your auditorium and basically you said, so just want you to know, we're starting this other thing over here and it looks a lot more like, you know, real problems and kids' passions and, you know, all those things we talk about. I'm convinced in just about every district anywhere that you'd get 10% of people's hands going up. Yeah, I want that. Because this thing over here really isn't working for my child, right? And that's a start. That's just a start to say, yeah, let's give that option to the kids and the parents who might want it. We can show that the outcomes in terms of at the end product, whatever you want to call it, is the same. Kids can go to college here, or they can go to college over there, or they can go into work. That's not different, but it's just a different path to get there. And I think that that's a real opportunity that we have. And I do think, again, that this moment will help us engage in those types of stories and to really think differently about what those pathways could be for kids in even in the same community.
Yeah, and those,
Scott, we're at a, you know, mentioned 5 minutes. And so if you or Chris have anything, I'm done, but if you guys have anything in the last 5 minutes, yeah.
I'm gonna wrap us up actually. You know, we'll go into what you just said here at the end. That feels like an easy sell to families and communities, right?
I agree, yep.
Right, guess what? You know, we're gonna step away from our monolithic approach to education. And I know that that instantly raises concern, but here's what we're going to put in its place, right? And your kid can do this, or your kid could do that, or your kid could do this. And then as Chris said in his wonderful comment he just made in our comment area, in our chat area, right? So it's kind of like Tangrams, right? Like you, or Legos, right? You assemble the blocks that make sense for your kid and your family. And, you know, how many families aren't going to want that, right? Like not a lot. So if we're, right, you know, brave and bold enough to start having those conversations and to start rethinking the essential, you know, historical inertia and structures by which we do learning, teaching, and schooling, it feels like we're going to have parents and families and kids as tremendous allies in this work. And particularly if we keep telling the story, as you mentioned, right, of how learning can look different and what that will do for your kid, right, which is awesome.
Yeah, I agree. Totally.
That's a great note to end on, right? Lots of rays of hope and positivity and some conversations to be held locally in local communities and across countries and communities about what could learning be instead? How do we tell those stories and how do we start assembling those Tangram-like pieces to build it in ways that make sense with a multitude of pathways for student success? There we go. That's our challenge, right? In our last 2 minutes here, I'll just kind of tell you what's coming up next for Silver Lining for Learning. Next week, the five primary hosts get together and make sense of our first five guests, which should be really fun. So we will not have any external guests on our episode. It'll just be the five or six of us chatting about meaning making and sense making, what some possibilities were. And then the following week, which will be episode 7 for us, we're gonna hear about Uruguay and what some national level remote learning looks like with some decent infrastructure and how we can maybe map that onto some of our conversations that we've been having so far. So with that said, Will, we are delighted to have had you with us today. Thanks for giving us some of your very precious time. It's been a great conversation. And everybody else, we will see you next week for episode 6. Thanks so much for listening. Bye.